Hello and welcome to this episode of the LangFM podcast. My guest today is Holly Bale, an interpreter and translator from Dallas, Texas. Hello, Holly. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we got this sorted out with all the time zones and everything. It's always difficult for Europeans. I don't know. I suppose you are more used to working with different time zones in your professional life as well, aren't you?
Yes, to a certain extent, since we have four different time zones just in the U.S.
That's right, yeah. You're talking to us from Dallas, and I must admit, I only knew Dallas from the TV show from when I was young. And I know Europeans like to make fun of CNN when they mix up countries like Slovenia and Slovakia, but I think the Europeans are just as bad when it comes to U.S. geography. So I looked up Dallas. It's in Texas, that's right?
Right. So Texas is sort of along the southern border of the U.S., right in the center, and Dallas is actually North Texas. We're a good 8 to 10 hour drive from the southern border.
Wow, that's a long time. It's a big state, isn't it, Texas?
Yes, it's the third largest. So yeah, really big.
Wow. Okay. So you're a certified translator with the American Translators Association and a Texas licensed court interpreter. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Can you tell us a bit more about what that means? The certification?
Sure. So for the translation, the American Translators Association offers certification exams. And it's a nationally recognized certification. So you take a translation test, and if you pass it, then you are authorized to call yourself a certified translator by the American Translators Association. And then on the interpreting side, that's a state credential, basically, that is the licensed court interpreter. There are two designations, basic and master, depending on how you fare on the exam. Mm-hmm. And that one basically gives you the credential to be able to interpret in court proceedings in Texas.
And you wouldn't be able to do that without the licensing or the certification?
For court interpreting, theoretically you do need the licensing to be able to practice in courts, but there's a lot of progress to be made to make sure that standard is kind of upheld.
Because as far as I can tell, that's a bit of an issue in some of the European countries where I think you don't necessarily have to have the certification as a translator or an interpreter to work for the courts, but the judge can just say, okay, I'll pick this person to be the interpreter for this trial, which they would often do for the smaller languages because mm-hmm. it's just so difficult to find the right people. But is that an issue in Texas as well, or is it mainly just Spanish and English?
Yeah, it's absolutely an issue. And even though there are so many Spanish English interpreters available, even in that language, there's a lot of lack in good practices in courts. So we do have that issue with the less widely known languages, but also even with Spanish.
Yeah. But let's go back to the start, maybe. I'm interested in how you became an interpreter and maybe why as well. Because it's not the typical dream job, I think. You know, some people want to become, I don't know, like a policeman, maybe, or an astronaut. It's, the interpreters are not usually on that list. So what was the reason that you chose that career?
Well, that's a good question. I will say it wasn't originally my dream job because I hadn't really heard about it, but it did become my dream job once I got a little taste of it. So I always studied languages in school. I enjoyed that. Originally, I wanted to go into journalism and I had a few other ideas, but when I moved to Mexico to volunteer for a while, as I got more proficient in the language, I had some great opportunities to start doing some translation and interpreting in really informal kind of settings and really enjoyed it. And then I actually had my aha moment when I got the opportunity to interpret for a visitor who had come from the United States to Mexico at the time. And this visitor happened to have a pretty rare form of dwarfism. And we were able to set up a meeting with a young child who was about 8 years old who actually had that same form of dwarfism. And for me, it was just a really special time to be able to facilitate their exchanges to, you know, for this 8-year-old boy to be able to ask someone who was, you know, in his 20s, a little bit farther along in life, you know, what kind of get an idea of what what was awaiting him, gave him some hope and things like that. And it was just a special moment. And I kind of walked out of there saying, okay, I would like to really do this. I'd like to become a professional and keep facilitating these kinds of encounters.
And this was right after college?
It was actually right in the middle of college. I took a little break. I had advanced pretty quickly. And so when I was 18, I took a little break and went to Mexico and then came back and finished my degree. And at that point, I looked for a Spanish program and took translation courses to focus on that once I got back.
And that was in Texas as well? University or?
Yes, where I originally started in California, which is where I grew up on the West Coast. And then after I lived in Mexico, I finished school here in Texas.
Okay. Because I think that the most famous interpreter training courses that we would know, or that I would know, I think the one is in Monterey for conference interpreters, and there's one in somewhere at the East Coast. The name escapes me right now. But there are a few other possibilities for training as a court interpreter, I suppose, or a translator for that matter.
Yes, right now there are more and more training opportunities. When I was looking for a program, this was in 2005, the opportunities were much more limited. So I actually enrolled in one of the first translation certificate programs through the University of Texas at Arlington here in Texas when I was looking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after you finished your studies, how did that develop? Did you become a freelancer straight away, or did you make an internship or something like that?
I actually did freelance right away. I actually started as a community interpreter, so going to hospitals and a few administrative hearings and things like that, because I didn't feel that I was really ready to be successful on some of the court interpreting exams. So I got a lot of experience, a lot of confidence, and studied for a really long time before taking my exams to get into courts.
That's great. And is this when Preciso started already, which is your company, is that right?
Right. So I founded a company right away. I originally called it something much more boring and rebranded a few years ago as I've grown a little bit. But yeah, I've been very fortunate to be able to freelance this whole time.
And have you always been on your own, or do you have some kind of network? How do you do that?
So mostly on my own. Over the past year or so, I've been able to kind of partner up with a few local interpreters that I kind of like to work with. And so we help each other out, you know, when we have some client needs that go a little bit beyond what just one person can do.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I've been able to develop.
And you work mainly with English and Spanish?
Yes. Yeah, I actually do exclusively English and Spanish. And then if something else, you know, comes in, I refer it out to some colleagues that I know around town.
Excellent. And I saw on your website that you have an informal dinner, is that once a month or with other interpreters translators from the Dallas area?
Yeah, I'm glad you saw that. It's actually a really, really great little meetup that we've been doing for a little over a year now. We get together once a month, and it's specifically for court interpreters in the area and for people who are interested in the profession. So we just get together. It's informal. We get together for dinner. It's been a good time to get to know each other and talk about some issues that we all face, and also get to know some students and people who are interested in coming into the profession, because before, since basically here in this area, there are almost no staff interpreter jobs, and there's very little oversight of interpreters in court. And so we're all kind of like lone wolves, you know, going to our jobs every day and coming home. So it's been great to get to know everyone a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think that those informal gatherings are really, really great, because I went to just one of those informal gatherings, I think, when I was still in university, and especially during my first years of freelancing when I started out in the profession. And it was so great to be able to talk to people who have done this for a while, who can give you some advice, who maybe face the same problems. And it was great. And for those who work mainly at home, i.e. the translators, it was a great way just to socialize and meet other people, which you can't always do from the home office. So it's great that this exists. But this one is informal. It's not associated with a professional association or something.
Right. That this one specifically, we kind of designed it to be separate from different associations so that it would be more accessible, so people wouldn't have to feel like, oh, well, I have to join some organization to attend or anything like that. It's just super informal. Anyone can come, and it's worked out really great.
So how many people usually show up? Is it a really big thing?
It's relatively big. Right now, at this point, we've had 20 to 25 people every month.
Mm-hmm.
So it's relatively big for the amount of professionals that we have in the area, sure.
That's very nice, yeah. And you say it's a mix between students and more seasoned colleagues, but mainly court interpreters.
Right, so that particular gathering is really dedicated for court interpreters, and we do have some students and a lot of people who are already working in the profession.
Yeah. You talked about volunteering and your time in Mexico, and I also saw on your website that you still do quite a bit of... you called it, I think, pro bono translation, so volunteering for the Human Rights Initiative of Dallas and Camp Summit. Can you tell us about that, maybe?
Sure. I really always enjoyed volunteering in different levels and supporting nonprofit organizations in different ways. And so right at the moment, for example, Human Rights Initiative of Dallas has been working a lot. I don't know how much of our news gets over there, but we had a very large wave of Central American immigrant children come across our borders.
Mm-hmm.
And Human Rights Initiative was working to assist some of those cases, especially when they had legitimate asylum claims, to try to help some of those cases. So I was able to do some volunteer translations for some of those cases. And then Camp Summit is actually a great program here around Dallas-Fort Worth, and it's actually a free summer camp for children with disabilities. And so I was able to do some help them get some promotional materials into Spanish so that they can increase their outreach to the Hispanic community here.
That's great, yeah. And I think it's probably also a nice to just do something else and give back a bit to these courses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we have a similar migrant issue at the moment in Europe, but it's a different situation for you, I guess, because the people that come, they come mainly from Mexico or South America or Latin America. And I think here it's a much bigger variety of languages, so a different challenge as well to get the right interpreters and the right translators to be able to give those people that have a fair claim a fair chance as well to state their case. So it's difficult. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, but this is really nice. So we talked about this informal dinner as well, and I think it would be quite interesting for us, or for me, from the European perspective, to learn a bit more about the interpreting or translation scene in Dallas and maybe Texas. You seem to be quite up to speed with that, so maybe you can tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. So I personally do translations and court interpreting and a little bit of conference interpreting. I wouldn't want to talk too much about the conference interpreting scene because I don't do as much of it as some of my colleagues. But as far as court interpreting, it's very interesting time for our profession right now, because basically there's laws on the books and there are mandates from the executive branch that discuss that it's a civil right for people who don't speak English fluently to have language access when they come to courts. And so each state here is very independent in the way they interpret and apply certain things. And so for Texas in particular, as I mentioned before, we have kind of a scattering of applications in different courts. Some judges and some courts are very, very strict about making sure that they have qualified court interpreters available, and others are still kind of, you know, they like to, or they allow maybe an attorney to interpret and be an attorney for their client at the same time, or maybe they ask people to come in and use their friends or family members to interpret. And then you know, really we need to get to the point where the clients who don't speak English are not paying for their own interpreter service, which also happens a lot. So we have these issues that need to be focused on. And then some other states have actually been subject to lawsuits by the federal government because of these exact kinds of issues. And so what some of us are hoping to work for is to improve the legislation in our own state, and hopefully we can make some changes instead of waiting for a top-down mandate from the federal government to force some of these changes in sort of a bureaucratic, you know, top-down way. Maybe we can create some of those changes and implement some best practices.
Wow. That was very interesting, especially the thing with the fees. So you say it sometimes happens that you have to pay for your own interpreter during a court case. It's not paid for by the state.
Right. So in criminal cases, typically, we do have pretty good practices there where the state will pay for it. But in any kind of civil case, with a few exceptions, the client is expected to pay for their own interpreting services. So that's an additional fee that they pay that an English speaker wouldn't pay.
Yeah. Interesting. And there are there any statewide rules on what the fees are, or can you just charge whatever you want, basically?
In that sense, we are fortunate from our professional perspective in that we don't have like statewide mandated fees. The closest thing that we have around here is that certain counties have a set fee that they pay if you're actually hired by the courts. But beyond that, each of us is kind of on our own to set our fees. So we're fortunate in that sense.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Let's maybe stay in the area of law and language, because it's really very, very interesting. And I've been following not only in your website, but also on Twitter, that you were working with a person who wrote a dictionary, actually, for legal terminology. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That was a really fun project. I was fortunate to meet last year when I was actually doing some studying for court interpreting exams in Tucson, Javier Becerra, who is a professor in Mexico, and he has written some really great specialized dictionaries that are English, Spanish, Spanish, English, and they're really focused on U.S. and Mexican law. So after I met him, he was nice enough to grant me an interview, and then we were able to get that published in the American Translators Association magazine. So that was a lot of fun.
It's a very good interview, by the way. I read it. And I mean, it's not only very interesting, but it's also very well written. I really enjoyed the read. I'll put it into the show notes for the podcast so other people can also read it. It's very nice.
Thank you.
And it sounds like a very interesting project. So but you're not working with him on the dictionary. You just talk to him about it and probably use the dictionaries yourself.
Right. I use the dictionaries with a lot of gratitude in my heart every time I have a tricky legal document to translate. But no, I'm not actually working with him on the dictionaries, although I'm very curious to see how it plays out with some of the new digital offerings that he's trying to come out with.
Yeah, because you hinted at that in the interview, that it may come out as an electronic edition as well, which
right.
I think brings us nicely to the next topic, which is technology. So I already mentioned your website several times and your mm-hmm. blog, and you're also quite active on Twitter. And I saw on your website that you have a wallpaper for mobile phones with your logo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, by the way, that's maybe a nice segue. Can you tell us about the logo a bit more? Who made it and where the idea came from? It's a little bird, right? With the Texas, like with a typical Texas hat and the cowboy boots.
Right. Well, that's actually a special edition of my logo. So if you go to the website, to my website, you have the normal logo, which actually doesn't have a cowboy hat and boots. It's just a bird that kind of, you know, originally the concept was it kind of represents communication because of their songs. Actually, it's very interesting. The state bird of Texas is a type of bird that learns sounds around it, and it can have a repertoire of like 60 different tunes that it will sing. So if there's, you
That's
know,
cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. And then the colors on it are the colors of a famous flower in Mexico. But 1 year for the American Translators Association conference, I made a Texas version of it. That way people would have an easier time identifying where I was coming from. And it was such a hit that I have, you know, little stickers with it. And everyone loves the one with the birds, with the boots and the hat. So I might just do away with the old one.
Yeah, I could just switch to that altogether. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very nice idea. Yeah. And yeah, speaking of Texas, I wanted to talk to you about tablets as well, because I think the way I learned about you was somebody shared, maybe on Twitter, probably on Twitter, actually.
Probably, yeah.
Your two posts about the paperless interpreter experiment. And you basically did an experiment where you tried to use a tablet instead of paper, hence the name paperless interpreter experiment. For those of us who have not read the blog post, which are very nice, by the way, can you maybe tell us where the idea came from and how it all went and what you did.
Sure, yeah. Well, let me just say I'm glad that you and I met on Twitter through our mutual love of technology and tablets. So what happened was, as I started getting really, really busy in court interpreting, I was buying these bulk packs of legal pads to take my notes on. Probably, I don't know how often, maybe every month or something. I was just going through tons and tons of paper, and it just made me start thinking, like, there's got to be a better way than, you know, carrying around these notebooks, and then sometimes I pull out my notebook and it's actually full, you know, and I don't have a fresh notebook, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, pens die and whatnot. And so I started kind of playing around with thinking, you know, there has to be a solution for this. So originally I started with an older, I think it was like a second gen iPad that I tested, and really kind of determined that it was a little too glitchy to take notes on, because I would be taking notes and then the app would crash. And so I was okay, this, I can't handle this.
No.
But later on I found a Samsung tablet that actually is called the Galaxy Note Tab. And it has a little stylus that's actually, it has a nesting spot within the tablet. And so I won't go into all the details, but the long story short is that it's worked really, really great. And I still use it to this day to take my notes on. It's wonderful.
It was great, yeah, because I remember you were using sort of two apps side by side, and I was really, really jealous because back then this was not possible on iPads. It's going to be possible, at least on the more recent iPads starting in the fall when iOS 9 comes out. But you were already using that back then. So you had the notes, I think, on one side and some, probably a dictionary on the other side.
Yeah, so with Samsung's native apps, which is what actually what I use to take notes on. It's just called S Note. It's their native note-taking app. You can you can shrink the screen, and then on the other side, you can put really whatever you want. If you want to put your glossaries or a dictionary that you want to be able to access while you're interpreting or whatever you like.
Yeah. And did you use a stylus for that? I think the Samsung one has a built-in stylus even.
Right, yeah. So I use the Samsung one with the built-in stylus, and I've never had any issues with it. It's a good fit for my hand, so I've never really needed to buy an extra stylus or anything. And I like that it nests in the tablet because I have never lost it.
Yeah, that's a smart idea. That's true. But I also have my memories of buying huge stacks of legal pads when I was in university, because the teacher that taught us notation and all the techniques and symbols, she was very particular about what kind of pen to use and what kind of pad to use. And of course, we followed the instructions very precisely. And then whenever we got to a shop that would have those specific pads, we would just buy them. But I think at some point we just had to buy so many that we stopped, and then we built our own from old scratch paper and that kind of thing. So it's really nice. But what you said right now has happened to me as well, the other way around, because I forgot to bring a pad, and I had just one pen, and you know, everything didn't work, and I ended up using the iPad then as a digital notepad, and it worked just fine, which sort of was my paperless interpreter experiment, just a bit the other way around maybe. but that's very nice. Yeah, but I saw as well that you had a few app recommendations and applications that you use, for example, to track expenses. Expensify is the one you use, right?
Yeah, so I do use Expensify. Basically, anything that has to do with accounting, I want to automate it as much as possible, because otherwise it'll stack up on me and then it just becomes a mess. So Expensify is great because you link whatever your business accounts are for banking, you link them right into Expensify. You can set it up so that certain types of recurring expenses are automatically categorized. So, you know, for example, for me, I park at parking lots and courthouses, so I spend on parking every day. And so when Expensify recognizes a parking fee on my account, it will automatically categorize it. So I don't even have to look at that again. Just at the end of the year, I hit one button and it spits out a report with how much I spent in each category. So I really, that's really amazing. Love things like that. Yeah.
And then you can just use that to invoice your clients and get the money as soon as possible, hopefully.
Yeah, I think Expensify, I don't use it for invoicing. I use actually another free program called Express Accounts for invoicing. So yeah, someday maybe I'll get something that can do it all in one, but I kind of like the solution that I've come up with at the moment.
And then you use another app for time tracking. And I was wondering what you use that for, what kind of projects you would time track. Is that for translation or for... I saw that as well. And we need to talk about that as well. You do transcription and translation of video. Do you use it for that, the time tracking app?
Yeah, so I use it mostly for internal purposes. It's called Timesheet, and it's really great. You kind of set up, you can have different projects going, and you just put a widget. For me, since I have Android, I can put a widget on my home screen, and it's just one touch to start and stop the clock, and then I can see what I'm spending on each project. Most of my projects, I don't actually bill for time. If I'm doing it at home, like a translation or a transcription, but I kind of use it for my own internal purposes to see, like, okay, I bid X amount, and then I see, well, how long did I actually spend on that job? And then I kind of see if I need to adjust my rates next time.
That is a very smart thing to do, I think, yeah. Because I think very often we don't really know how much time a certain thing or a certain project takes. And I think that's a very smart thing to do. And there's another time-related app that I saw, which was Clockwork Tomato for the Pomodoro technique. Maybe you can quickly explain what Pomodoros are for those of us who have never heard of it.
Yeah, so the Pomodoro idea is that you are going to train yourself to have 25 minutes of uninterrupted focus on one single task, and then followed by 5 minutes of kind of free time to, you know, get your water or whatever you need, as far as I understand it. I'm also not the expert, but that's what I understand. Mm-hmm. And then I just was looking for a little app that kind of works in the same way as Timesheet, where I can very easily start and stop it. It'll kind of ding me when I need to get back to work. It'll ding me when I can take a break and things like that. And so that's what Clockwork does.
And it works well for you, the Pomodoro technique, because I've tried it. It's not for me. I don't know why.
Well, you know, I think it helps me in one sense, because I have so many things coming in with Twitter and email and things like that. So when I have a project I just need to make progress on, that's kind of what I use it. Not every day, but I use it for things like that. And I don't know if I'm really using it, because what I usually end up doing is I sit down and I skip breaks. I skip like 6 breaks. And so I sit and work for like 3 hours and then get up and take a break. So I'm not exactly using it. I think it's more of a mental construct to help me focus.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, if it works, that's great.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to ask you if you work with glossaries, if you make your own glossaries, and if yes, if you have a specific app for that or a technique that you use.
You know, I think that's an area that I need to find a solution for, because I do have some kind of disparate glossaries in Excel, and every once in a while I'll try to work on them and update them, and I'm just not that studious about that. So if you have any recommendations, I'd be glad to hear them.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not as not as diligent about that either. So I probably should be. But I'm just curious to see what colleagues use. I don't know. Do you have the opportunity to look at a glossary when you're in the courtroom working, or is that possible at all?
You know, it is possible, and we definitely do it, and best practices to do it when, you know, you're kind of caught off guard, you really don't know a word. But on the other hand, we also have a lot of pressure not to hold up the proceedings. And so I would say that most of the time we're not really using glossaries or dictionaries, although we should always have them with us so that if something, you know, does kind of come out of left field, we can check it out.
Sort of as a fallback, just in case.
Yeah, and also during breaks, you know, if there was anything that I'm like, oh, I have the idea that maybe I said something I need to correct it, I'll go check on the break. And then when I go back, you know, I might say, Your Honor, I need to correct, you know, X, Y, or Z that I said, it should have been this other thing.
Yeah, I see. Mm-hmm. So what is summer like for you? Is it a slower period where you have less work? Do you do other things? Do you travel, I suppose, to a Spanish-speaking country, something like that?
For summer, well, we don't have as much of a slowdown here during the summer because everyone's not off at the same time. So a lot of people do go on vacations, but it's sort of random people. So I would say in general, business doesn't slow down for me too much, except for at the end of the year, the last 2 weeks of the year.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, summer here is the time when a lot of, you know, since children are out of school, people take vacations. And I do end up going to Mexico usually about twice a year. And I'm looking forward to going next month, actually.
Yeah, it's not that far away after all.
Yeah, I'm counting down for sure.
Do you have a favorite spot that you like to go in Mexico?
Well, when I was living there, I lived in Mexico City, so that's usually where I go. I've also had the opportunity to go to a couple of nice beaches like Puerto Vallarta, so if I have time to do that, I will definitely go out of my way to go there.
Must be a great destination. I mean, Mexico City sounds very scary to me because it's just so big and so many people.
Yeah.
But I've heard from a lot of people that the beaches are very, very nice in Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico City is in a really, really amazing city. It's super cosmopolitan, and yes, it's very, very large. And yeah, the beaches are amazing. There's a lot of kind of outdoor adventures, if you like that. There's a lot of places where you can go caving or hiking, rafting, all of those things.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. Okay. Listen, Ollie, it was really nice to talk to you and get a bit of insight into your working life and into what interpreting and translating is like in Dallas, Texas. Thank you very much for taking the time. This was really, really interesting.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Okay. Then enjoy your vacation. Everybody else, enjoy your vacation too. And talk to you soon on Lang FM.